Hello, Billy Patterson here. Nearly 30 years ago on my Castaway programs, I talked with local people about their lives. Stay tuned and listen again to the following fascinating story.
I'm delighted to welcome the First Lady on Castaway this week, and her name is Joan McGinley from Teelin. And Joan was very much involved in the attempts to improve the rescue services on the west coast of Ireland, and I suppose particularly Donegal, but we'll talk about that later. Joan, Cead Míle Fáil.
Thank you.
Joan, do you want to tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Derry, 1952, in what people would know as the Waterside area. And, take it from there.
All right. Tell me about your parents.
My parents?
Both well and...
Yeah, both still well and living. My mother was a Tipperary woman from Cashel. And my father was, while he was from Strabane, initially, his own father was born in Redcastle, or above Drum, in the Inishowen Peninsula. So you might say 26 county blood there.
That's
through
right,
through.
Quite a lot of it. Your name was Joan O'Doherty.
That's right.
That's right. Now, what about school? Did you enjoy school, Joan?
No.
Didn't enjoy it at all?
No,
why?
Not at all. Enjoy it at all.
You're a bright girl, weren't you?
I wasn't interested in school. I think it was in the Derry area at the time. I mean, you hear a lot about John Hume being the first of the Catholics who got education, free education. So you had that grouping, who were a slight generation before me.
Mm.
I think I maybe was the next generation that... It's like if you give anyone something free and people have a value on it because they know what it was like not to have it.
Mm.
But I was a generation where it was accepted that you were going to have it. And education too, I think, particularly in my family, was seen very much for the academic purpose of it. And, I was very involved in school debates and things like this. And I think one of the earliest lessons I learned was the meaning of education, the Latin. It was derived from the Latin to mean draw out. And I realised that the education system I was in was not drawing anything out, but
pumping
instilling
in.
Things
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah.
And I reacted very much to that because I knew what I wanted to draw out, but it wasn't part of the system I was involved in. So I didn't enjoy school, and I didn't enjoy exactly what was going on, nor did I enjoy the social pressures that went with it in teenage years at all.
Well, you were going to school, you know, right at a bad time in the north, weren't you?
Well, no, that sort of happened later. I mean, I also went to single-sex schools, and that didn't appeal to me. I mean, from primary school, I was in single-sex school, and I went from there then to a convent school. Just the whole...
You don't like the idea of segregated education?
No, I didn't like segregation. I didn't like the fact that an individual wasn't considered, and there was no attempt to draw you out or to do anything with you. It was putting in. I didn't feel that people were... We're interested in people. I think there was a big march on to achieve a status, and people looked upon people as objects, and that didn't appeal to me at all. Life is short, and I'm very happy the way I am, and I always was, even though there'd be conflicts going on, because you were scratching beneath the surface, you were asking questions, and you were taking responsibility for whatever decisions you made.
Mm.
I just find life too exciting to go into, always did.
Yeah, the whys and the wherefores. Yeah.
I go into very much the whys and wherefores of life and why.
No, but you mean
a
personality. Just get on with it and without sort of saying, okay, where did I get it?
No, I think life is something, a gift each of us has, and you make the most of it.
Mm.
But you don't allow people to... Too often, people go down road and say, but if I hadn't let my mother do this or my father do that.
Mm.
As far as I was concerned, my life was mine.
Mm.
And I
mm.
would take responsibility for whatever I did with it.
Was that from a very early age, Joan?
I think my family would say yes. I mean, one of my earliest memories on the independence streak was I remember one Christmas being quite sick. I was 15. And earache or something. Anyway, I was missing out on Christmas. And Christmas was on a Monday or something, because we'd missed the papers the day before, and someone came up to me anyway, because I had written a letter to the Sunday press and on some issue, it was corporal punishment or something. But I think that was the first indication at home that they were getting worried that I was stepping out of line a bit more publicly than I should.
Yeah, you weren't in the mould.
Yes, that's right.
Joan, you know, before we go any further, that you're going to get Six Records. Take this island with you.
Can I say there that when you invited me first to this island, I mean, my immediate reaction was no, because I never give personal interviews, blah, 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 and all the rest. But when I put up the phone, because you said think about it, I thought, you know, this is what I always dreamed of. I mean, I always just wanted to get away on my own.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't resist it.
The idea appeals to you, doesn't
oh,
it?
Oh, tremendously.
Yeah, so if you were shipwrecked and you had your few bits and pieces around you, you wouldn't mind being there for a while.
I don't think I'd be looking to get back in.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that later. But you have got one of these solar-powered record players with you,
oh,
right? So you can have six records because there's plenty of sun.
Right.
So what would your first choice be and why?
Well, I think the easiest way when you asked me on this was to do it a bit in chronological order because it brings things through,
sure.
Right? I grew up in the 60s. I was a teenager in the 60s, right? And for most people that was the Beatles and Stones, all that there. It was for me too. I mean, I wasn't out of the ordinary in that at all. But growing up in Derry, and I think it's mainly Derry people will appreciate this record. The record that sums up the joy or the spunk I got out of my teenage years, because even though I said I didn't enjoy school, there was lots of vital things going on around and lots of things I remember with tremendous happiness. But one of them that sums up a lot that went on around that time that was good was Runaway Bunyan by Phil Coulter. Now everyone's going to go, what? I mean, even at home, my son, when he heard, I mean, it's a bit of a joke in our house, he said, you better not play that because people will be asking for their Christmas cards back. it's the flip side of Phil Coulter's Derriere. So in asking for Runaway Bunyan, I know I'd be getting the two sides of the record, okay? And it's very much in the style of Mrs. Mills, but it was played at all the parties that I went to.
So that was the big hit at the time was Runaway Bunyan.
It was the big Derry hit
all
at
right,
the time.
Well, okay. Sure. Let's hear it, John. Okay, that was part of Phil Coulter's Runaway Bunyan, a big hit at the time that you were growing up in Derry, Joan. What about brothers and sisters?
I have three brothers, all older,
yeah,
and I have two younger sisters. I think I should say too, my father is one of six boys, and his mother died when he was just two. So there are a lot of stories going around of how he reacted in Derry when I was born.
Really?
You know,
how did he react?
Oh, well, he's meant to. I mean, he was his own mother as he died and he was young. He grew up with all men. Then when he got married, he'd three sons. And so I think when the first girl arrived, it doesn't take much imagination.
He went stone mad.
Yeah. But
did he take a glass of sherry on that evening?
Yes, I think that could be said.
Fair enough.
But I don't think I turned out exactly what he might have liked his first
know.
Maybe that was part of the problem, too. I mean, I can remember at an early age, too, One time, I was about 10, we used to go on holidays every year to Moville or Shrew or that part of the world. We went there every weekend as well. But I remember we had this long-running battle because I had short hair. I kept my hair very short. And he kept bribing me to grow it,
oh,
you know.
I see.
So whether there was this rebel thing built in at early stages of maybe someone wanting you to be something, I don't know. I don't know.
What you mean. But a lot of male influence in your life, you see, this is a problem as well.
Problem?
Yeah.
I mean, is it a problem?
Well, I would have thought for the sort of the first girl in a long line of boys with a lot of men around you, you would, it wasn't fluffy things and frilly dresses you were interested in. You were listening to men talking from a very early age, probably.
Yeah, that's probably it too. But we also lived in quite an isolated place. I mean, we didn't live in a street or anything, and we didn't live with other families around us. And, I mean, I think at a very early age, too, there was a bit of a gap between my next sister. And it seemed my next sister and the younger sister would have got on more. And then the boys, of course, didn't want me. I was all right for goalkeeper, but not much more, you know. My memory of myself, my parents' memory might be very different, but my memory of myself would have been that I had a lonely childhood. I was on my own. I enjoyed being on my own, but I was on my own a lot. I would go off and do things on my own.
By choice. I mean, was it that the others that were boys that didn't play with you but the first girl?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, I don't have any resentment there, so it must have been by choice. You know, I don't feel, I was left out. Why was I on my own? You know,
Do you think that there's something good about being a sort of a solitary, a lone person as a child, which prepares you for life or something? Have you thought about that?
But when I say I was solitary as a child, I mean, I wasn't solitary. I had lots of friends, but my friends were not of the same age, and I would still maybe find that problem. I'm not a good social mixer.
Yeah, I meant mentally, sort of.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is sometimes people think then you're off on your own, but I'd like to stress the fact that I had lots of people that I liked being with, but I was never good with my own age group, and I would hold that's still true. I am not... I am not a convivial social mixer. Or I don't regard myself as such. You know.
All right. Let's see what you did then. At school, you started a girls' club. Right?
No. I mean, at school, I would have been involved in the...
I'm sorry. This is after that. No,
debating society. No, the girls' club would have been while I was meant to be at school and still at school. I had tremendous... you mentioned the male influence.
Yeah.
It was the era where you had boys' clubs. It was the era, you know, before youth clubs, where you had boys' clubs, but you didn't have girls' clubs because they weren't deemed the men to have them.
So?
So, this wasn't on, and I got a girls' club going with a lot of hassle. I would have been about 15 at that time.
Yeah.
Got premises and got things moving. With the overall intention of getting this into a mixed club at one point, but I mean there was a lot of opposition to that. I mean, but it's now there because in many ways it was the foundation of the Waterside Youth Club. They had a boys club, but it was having this girls club going for so long, which I remember started off in a band shed up in Fountain Hill in Waterside. Anybody listening will remember that. That's what started.
I'm still trying to find out, Joan, whether you did this as a feminist or you did it because you're against segregation, for segregation of girls you're not interested in, or are you, segregation of boys, or do you want to see much more ecumenism in many, many departments of our life?
Well, you see, that's probably it. I mean, you're saying feminist, whatever. I mean, some people might say I'm a feminist. I just say I'm a humanist. I'm interested in human people and human dignity. I mean, I'm very conscious of how people... I would say the element of feminism is something I'm only now starting to think about. And maybe it was always there, because I always felt tremendous resentment at how people took dignity from other people. Now, because I was a woman, then I felt it was taken from me. But at an early age, I never saw it strictly in those terms. Although now, looking at historically elements and things, yeah, probably it was, you know, this feminist thing. Because people were expected to do A, B and C and respond in such a manner. But that wasn't necessarily how they felt. And I suppose what I've always wanted to do in life is to have the freedom myself to respond how I want to, and to allow other people that freedom.
Tell me what your second record is, and we'll play it after the ad break. What would your second choice be?
Can I say something on it?
Yes, please? You can, of course.
My second choice is Scorn Not His Simplicity by Phil Coulter.
Phil Coulter.
Well, these are that era.
Right.
But it was about, he wrote it about a mentally handicapped child he had. I worked for a while in with mentally handicapped kids in Dublin, and I also had a mentally handicapped aunt. And the experience I had working in Dublin, I must say, was in all the years of life, it was only for a 6-month period, but I remember vividly every kid I worked with. And nearly every day of that I did there. I worked for an organisation called St Michael's Parents and Friends. They're still in existence. And I can honestly say that while I was only getting £8 a week, they were the best employers I have ever worked for, of how they treated anyone who worked for them, the role they saw you had with the people, and how you were involved in decision-making and work with the children. It was, I would say, one of the most richest experiences I had from many, many points of view. And scorn of simplicity was so true in all it said and all it represented for me at that time.
See the child with the golden hair but eyes that show the emptiness inside. Do we know? Can we understand just how he feels, or have we really tried? See him now, as he stands alone and watches children play a children's game. Simple child, he looks almost like the others, yet they know he's not the same. Simplicity, but rather try to love him all the more. Scorn not his simplicity, oh no, oh no. See him stare, not recognizing that kind face that only yesterday he loved. The loving face of a mother who can't understand what she's been guilty of. How she cried, tears of happiness, the day the doctor told her it's a boy. Now she cries, tears of helplessness, and thinks of all the things he can't enjoy. Scorn not his simplicity, but rather try to love him all the more. Scorn not.
Scorn not his simplicity, a Phil Coulter composition sung there by Luke Kelly. My guest, if you've just joined us on Castaway, is Joan McGinley. Joan, you were telling me there that you weren't interested in going to university, yet you had pretty good results from your exams. Why were you not interested in university?
Well, I mean, I'd already had enough of school and all. I think I said earlier, I didn't like this idea of being constantly with your own age group. And I thought university, I knew at 18 years of age my strengths and weaknesses, or I thought I did. Looking back, I think I was fairly accurate. And knowing my weaknesses, that I don't think are necessarily for the public broadcasting,
okay,
I realised I did not want to spend the next 3 or 4 years of my life with people of a similar age group.
Why? What did you got against
that? Well, I'd say that was part to do with my own weaknesses that I recognised at that point in time, but knew that for ways that what I wanted to develop, it would not be a healthy environment for me. Also, because of what I had spent the previous number of years doing, which was involved in activities in the community with all age groups, young, middle age, every age group, that's what I was interested in. I was also very politically aware, but not with a big P, with small P, of why people cannot have a voice, why it is only certain people run a show, and that whole dynamics that goes on. And from quite an early age too, I worked with Down and Outs in Dublin. When other people took summer holidays to the beaches, I went off to work with Down and Outs in Dublin during my school holidays. I was interested in how people are marginalised and everything else. So somewhere along the line, I discovered that there was a course in a place in England called West Hill that did train people as youth workers, but also had an aspect of it that was concerned with community development, which was exactly what I was looking for. But more important, the course was based in a college that was a Quaker foundation and that was multi-denominational, which very strongly appealed to me as well.
Mm.
And people on the course had to be minimum of 19, but they were any age from 19 to 65.
Mm.
So it meant I was going to be one of a group of 28 people across a wide age range, mm-hmm. from a wide background, experiences, as well as religious. And that was what I was looking for at that age. So that's what I gave myself towards.
Yeah, that appealed to you.
Oh,
where was it, did you say?
In Birmingham, West Hill. West Hill College.
West Hill College in Birmingham. Did that affect your thinking, Joan? What did it do for you precisely?
Well, this was now 1970, went there. And
the troubles were just brewing up here.
The troubles had already been on 2 years. So, I mean, I don't think you can divorce what has happened. I mean, in the early days in Derry, I was very involved. I mean, people that remember exactly how the troubles started will remember the housing situation in Derry and how there were so few houses and the gerrymandering and all that.
Mm.
And at that time in Derry, I got involved with a group who were based at McGee, who were doing housing surveys to sort of root in fact just how bad the situation was. And one of them, Peter Tarleton, who I think is now a minister in the Church of Ireland somewhere in this country, he himself and myself got involved in getting a flat. You see, we went and got the premises, but if I had gone to get them because I was a Catholic, I couldn't get them. But because he was Protestant, he could get the keys to the flat.
Sure.
And it was down in Great James Street, above... can't remember now, it was a music shop, I just can't remember the name of it. Anyway, we worked at getting that flat into some shape,
mm-hmm.
and put in a family. You see, in Derry at the time too, you had many people that were married maybe for 15 years or whatever, but had never lived together, because the nature of housing was she would live with her parents, he would live with his.
Bad as that?
That was very bad. People forget.
Were there many people like that, John? That's hard to believe.
Oh, well, I think people from Derry won't, they'll remember it.
Mm.
I mean, Derry, things have changed so dramatically, and it's amazing how people forget. I mean, I was recently at a seminar in Dublin, and people were talking on the political situation, and it had escaped everyone's attention that in the 60s, there was no such thing as one man, one vote. It was all done on rateable property valuation and things, and people have forgotten what the troubles came from. Anyway, going back to it, You were asking.
Yeah, you were talking about Peter and yourself getting the flat to put a family in.
That's right. But no, you were saying why this course appealed to me.
Oh yes, it was. Yeah.
Well, I'm saying, you know, that's the whole sort of background, and I'm saying that I can't divorce that while the troubles were going on, and Peter was someone who would be remembered from the early days of the troubles too.
Mm.
Where he got involved was in the housing situation.
Mm.
So, the troubles, you know, definitely would have had a bearing maybe in the direction I took, although there was foundation there before that. Of what direction I took.
Yeah. And you applied to Maynooth?
Well, that was before it was really that open, but they wouldn't even reply to me. I wanted to do theology. I mean, I was always very interested in philosophical and religious things, and I mean, I even worked in a retreat centre in my spare time in Scotland and things, but people can get bogged down and can spend time asking questions or justifying their behaviour, and meanwhile life is going past, right? And I think that's the point I would want to make. I'm conscious that life is there now, and I'm getting on with it. That's
get on.
It.
Okay. Let's go for your third record.
Right.
What will it be?
Third record was the very first classical record. Ours was not a house. I'd say it was, you know, typical of a lot. We didn't have records in the house. There wasn't even a record player in our house. The only record I can remember coming into our house was a guy coming in with bringing it in, and my brother playing Blue Suede Shoes.
Elvis.
Anyway, that's the thing. Anyway, the first classical record I was ever introduced to, ever properly introduced to, and by I mean introduced to by someone who loved it, was Swan of Twonela.
Mm.
And I must say that person's love definitely came over to me and opened up a whole new world, which was music.
Good. Let's listen to it.
Thank you.
music is so much part of our emotions.
It is. It's an emotion.
It's an ability to express emotions. Mm. And so, you know, when we played the Swan of Tuonela, I mean, that's when someone introduced me, because before I was brought up with thinking, oh, that's for educated, whatever,
eyebrows.
No idea of the power in it. Mm. And I find in music a tremendous oneness. Mm. And it either, I couldn't tell you good music from bad music. Music either does something for me or doesn't do something for me. And I make no apologies for either liking it or not liking it. And sometimes that can depend on the mood, because sometimes something that you think is great one day, you know, six months later, your whole being might be in a different state and it doesn't appeal, you know?
Mm. Yeah, interesting. All right, I just mentioned that in passing about teaching music. Then tell me about West Hill College. You spent 2 years there.
Over there, they use me as an example of cultural shock, because the first day I walked up a multiracial area in Birmingham, I mean, I didn't know what hit me. I mean, I come from quite a enclosed Catholic upbringing. Mm. West Hill was mainly, let's say there were 28 of us in the class, all age groups, was mainly about group work. Mm. And the whole course was based around group work, and you would work in groups of group dynamics before it was heard of in this country. That's what I was at for 2 years, you might say. Mm. So if that didn't help me face up to myself and who and what I was and what wasn't...
It's fairly intensive thing, is it? Is this where people really get into the nitty-gritty of what they're about and why they're there?
Yeah.
And they talk very personally?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the reason we were doing it, because you had to go through it to appreciate it, is because you were going to be working with people in informal situations, which are all normally groups, and this is where people can either thrive or sink. Mm. And it's only when you become aware of the various feelings you have in certain situations that you can then empathise or work with people when they're in such a situation.
But you're very young. I mean, you're 19.
Well, yes.
Sure, you hadn't experienced an awful lot to come to any sort of solid decisions about anything, did you?
Oh, well, that's not true. You see, I was old before my time. I was one of these people that was like an old woman by the time she was 18 or 19. I had, from an early age, and say I started the girls' club, I had... did a lot of work with old people. I also used to work every week in life in a home for girls at risk. Mm-hmm. And you forget I'd also worked in the down and outs in Dublin, and I also had worked in mentally handicapped. I mean, I had quite a bit.
And in
Derry too, when the Derry City Council was first disbanded, there was a movement to get a representative body underway. Mm. I'm trying to remember the name of it now, it's just slipped me. Anyway, I was a member of that too in my early days. So I was involved in an awful lot at a young age.
That's amazing. Instead of sort of dancing and discoing, you were out doing these things.
My free choice?
Yeah, it was, I know. From about, what, the age of 15 or something?
Maybe even a bit younger, yeah.
A bit younger. So you slipped into this thing at West Hill quite easily, didn't
it? Oh, yes, that was exactly what I was... I mean, the course was exactly what I was looking for. The environment was exactly what I was looking for. That's not to say I didn't find it very tough at times, emotionally and things. But, and looking back, it was the right thing at the right time, definitely.
Mm. From there you went to Scotland.
I did.
Community development worker.
That's right. I worked for the Ayrshire Community Development Service. In Scotland at the time, they were very, very go-ahead. They were, after 4 o'clock, the schools belonged to the organisation I was responsible for. Mm-hmm. We were responsible for caretaking of them, everything. They were handed over. Mm-hmm. Adult education. Mm-hmm. But we were also wider brief in the community. Mm-hmm. But the schools were our facilities.
Right.
So, I mean, that was... I was interested in, very interested there, and I enjoyed my period there.
Is that Coodham?
Coodham.
Coodham, what's Coodham?
Coodham is a very large, beautiful building outside Kilmarnock in Scotland that I think a lot of people in Scotland would be aware of, and people here maybe that have travelled over there. It was the Passionist House.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were still very much church at that time.
Yes,
yeah,
very
go
much.
On.
I had an uncle, a Passionist, so that's an aside. I got involved with this group before I realised they were Passionist. It was a retreat centre where they would have retreats for teenagers, late teenagers, adults, priests, nuns, various groupings. And because of my group work skills, I got involved there voluntarily at weekends, helping them organise and run retreats. Mm. You know, they're very much the sort of modern retreat, you know, the thinking large groups of young people down, good time and all the rest. Mm. And got quite involved there.
You did. You got a nice award there, didn't you?
Oh, no, that wasn't connected with that.
There?
No, sorry. That's
but while you were there, you got
while I was in Scotland.
Oh, Scotland.
Sorry.
Right, you got a Winston Churchill scholarship.
valued at about £15,000 at the time. That was for your community.
Well, the Winston Churchill Fellowships are available every year. I don't think they're worth as much now as they were then. But the year I applied was the first year that they had what they call open category. Every year they have a number of categories, and it's over to people. Joe Soap, this is the great thing about it. It isn't just academics, although academics apply as well. Over to anyone to apply, normally under special headings that they have out. But the year that I got it was the first year that they had an open category. In other words, you could say what you wanted to go and look at. And after all my years with community work and all, I was very conscious that the greatest shapers of our community weren't the church and weren't the education system, but were your means of employment. In other words, if a large factory was in the town and if they operated the shift system, then that told people a lot more, shaped people's lives more than any of the other things. And whatever form of work practice went on within the factory wall also told people more about themselves. And so I was very interested in the in business as the shaper of communities. And I don't think it was an angle looked at before. But I thought that Americans, in Britain at that time, there was a very low take-up in third-level education. I forget the percent, 5, 7%, something like that. It's much greater now, but remember, 20 years away. And in America at the time, it was much higher. So I reasoned that if a company was to keep an edge, then it would have to have good practices if it wanted intelligent people to work for it. And if it wanted its product to survive, it had to have, it would have to be ahead of people. It would have to have a concern for people. I mean, it was all a bit more convoluted than that.
Yeah.
But I had a theory. And I also had a theory about Northern Ireland, which I hoped to go back to at that stage. And I put it to the Winston Churchill board, and they gave me full head. So I went to the States and Canada for 3 months, visiting multinational corporations and government departments.
By putting your theory forward?
No, going and listening to see what was going on. Essence of it all was, I mean, you hear the terminology in this country now, but it's not understood, and it's like a lot of terminology. The further away it gets from its essence, the more distorted it gets, right? And at that, the word that would strike a bell with people is human resources. And now, I say, it's greatly misused, the term. But at the time, it was how companies would keep an edge, marketing-wise and also staff-wise, by being sensitive to the needs and requirements of people.
OK. Let's take another record. What would your fourth choice be, John?
My fourth choice would be Jonathan Livingston Seagull, because while I'd be on my desert island, I know I would hear the water lapping all the time. But the beginning of this record particularly is very special. Plus, the book Jonathan Livingston Seagull, I think, is just a fantastic book. For those who don't know it, maybe you might say it's a bit like my own beliefs. A seagull who wants to do more than the normal seagulls. He doesn't want to be, he's not ambitious in that he wants to be famous or anything. But it's about his own ability and striving to reach his own ability.
And this the record is by Neil Diamond.
That's right.
when you were in America, you got the opportunity to visit all these corporate heads, very big companies, and to, what? To learn from them, to learn how the companies operated, or what was your...
Well, I was going to listen and and to talk to them. You might say proving whether my theory was right or not, and I saw it was right. I mean, I find it very, very interesting, but more so than all that, it was the personal impact the trip had on me. I mean, first of all, you have to realise I was only 24, 25 years of age, and I organised it all myself, and going to meet all these guys. So, you know, there's a lot of logistical experience that was good, too, that I enjoyed.
These are the heads of large multinationals.
Multinationals, Exxon, Quaker Oats, I mean, you name them.
The big companies,
I met them.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And after these guys talked to you?
I mean, I was very disappointed. The only one that didn't meet me was Henry Kissinger. I was highly insulted that he sent his assistant to have lunch with me rather than
bad
himself.
Form.
You know, I thought, yes, very bad form. Yeah, you know, but that's... That was, you were beginning to get accepted like that. That was the great thing about America in those days, because you went in, they didn't see you as a woman or anything. They saw you for what you were there for.
Yeah.
You dealt on the subject and you went out. I mean, as soon as I came back to Britain, I remember going along on a similar topic with a group. I was going to work for a group and I was doing some freelance work with them. But one night when one of the men was leaving me home, I got my hair cut and he said that wouldn't do. And it was at that point I realised this was not for me in Britain at that stage, when someone was going to start interfering with me. Mm. But the thing that America did for me more than anything else was it was like someone taking you out of your life, letting you see where you might be 10, 20 years down the line,
yes,
and asking you if that's the direction you want to go in.
Mm.
And one of the sentences that comes over very strong from my trip in America, that a number of them said, these were guys top of their profession,
yes,
right, head of multinational corporations,
sure,
and they were saying if their lives lead again, they wouldn't do it. And in other words, it was like a scam, you know,
mm-hmm,
that there you are busy climbing to the top of something for what? I mean, you're always fed. I mean, there's stories written about it. There's a story about a butterfly, a caterpillar and all that. I mean, there's loads of religious stories written on it, you know, mm-hmm, of what is it all about. But here in reality, there they were, pinnacle in the world, not just even within Ireland or Britain, the world.
Mm-hmm.
And saying to me, and when you'd say to them, well, why don't you get out? They'd say, well, the kids are at college, the mortgage in the house, the wife. And there they were.
Mm. You're trapped?
Trapped.
And so they thought it would bring them happiness, Joan, and it didn't.
It wasn't that. No, they thought, they were a bit more intelligent than that. They thought it was about fulfillment.
Okay.
That this is it, right?
Well, I mean fulfillment.
Right,
yeah.
Fulfillment. Mm. And they realised. And so I took a couple of months off when I came back from the States and let everything sink in.
Mm.
Because, as I say, this was an opportunity to look at where I was going.
Mm.
And to think again. And I had a good couple of months thought, and I decided it wasn't for me, and I looked at aspects of my life. Up to then, you'd see, I was a very, very busy person.
You were. Mm.
And I decided, I mean, there was a lot of psychological elements. You can go into superior, inferior attitude to people. You know, there were all sorts of things. Why should I, at 18, be doing things to people? Why did they need me rather than me need them?
Mm.
All this, loads of things went on in my mind. The end result, anyway, was that I took my own life in hand. I started to have a social life, had a ball, and started to work on my own life. And really, that's where I am today.
Mm. You completely rechanged your attitude to a lot of things. All that thinking sort of developed your future attitude to everything.
I radically rethought.
Radically, I'm
internally grateful to General Lascelles, who was then in charge of the Winston Churchill Foundation, who was tremendous with me, because normally people are to go on to other things, and I got offered many jobs in the States and back in Britain when I came back, and you're expected to make your contribution, you know, back into society.
Sure.
He had tremendous understanding of what it had done to me, and I was tremendously grateful to them for that opportunity in life they gave me.
Okay, right, let's bring it a little more up to date. You went to Derry, right, when you came back.
For a very short period.
And you
yeah.
bought a house.
I did. That
you
was
did.
Part of my getting my own act together, my yeah. own wee scene.
Part of the 15 grand, or was that spent?
Oh, no, that was all on the scholarship.
That
I mean, I did 15 cities in 3 months, so, I mean,
that's spent,
a lot of
yeah,
travel.
A lot of money to right. be spent there. Now, you met your husband. Tell me mm-hmm. about your husband.
My husband was teaching in the Creggan and Derry in St. Joseph's.
What's his name?
Michael McGinley
right.
from St. Johnson. But he'd never tell anyone he's from St. Johnson. I've never heard him say he's from St. Johnson. He'll tell you he was from Ewe Island. But he left Dewey Island when he was 1 year old. So as far as he's concerned, but he spent every holiday in life back on Dewey Island.
We'll not tell anybody.
He's
from St. Johnson, right?
St. Johnson. He was teaching there.
Right.
But he was spending the summers fishing. And when I met him, he was making lobster pots in the back of the flat in Great James Street, getting ready for the summer fishing.
Really?
And
love at first sight?
Oh, not at all.
No?
No. No comment on the relationship.
Did you not think that it was funny for a man sitting in the middle of Derry making lobster pot?
No. Well, I mean, not prepared to go into that conversation. All I'll say is that he at the time was deciding between either doing marine biology in Galway, he was going to go back after 10 years teaching, or get a boat through BIM, whichever came through first. And he got a boat and decided he was going to go fishing, and I thought, right, that suits me. And so...
So you went to live in Teelin?
We did.
Right. You got married. What year was that?
I have to think.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
1977, I think.
So you're married to Michael at this stage. And off you went to Teelin. Okay, let's have another record now before we go a little further in your life.
Well, out there on the island too, I mean, you'd have to take the Four Seasons Vivaldi, because you're not going to have many seasons there, I wouldn't think, and just to remind you of what it was like. I particularly take the autumn because where I live, I think, is particularly beautiful in autumn time. The colours, I mean, people come to West Donegal in summertime, but they really miss it at its best. In autumn, you've got the purples, the oranges, you've got everything. You've got so much feeling and emotion there in the autumn time. So Vivaldi's the autumn to remind me of home.
Vivaldi's Autumn from the Four Seasons, right, John. All right, let's hear it. You're married to Michael, you're living in Teelin, and you had five kids, John.
Five children, yeah.
Five children in a short space of time.
Yeah, five.
You don't waste time, John, do you?
Well, life's very short. I've said that to you before. You know, you grab it while you can. I had 5 and 6 years.
My goodness. You were pregnant all the time?
No, I mean, I breastfed each kid. It was every time I stopped feeding I got pregnant.
I see.
So the mountain air does it, Billy.
And boys?
All boys. Well, I've four sons living. One died just after he was born.
Right.
Dermot, he actually would have been 10 now this year. Cormac's the eldest. He's 12. Cahill is 11. Micheál's birthday is the end of this week. He's 8. And Niall, who's 6.
All right. Tell me briefly, John, you know, you became terribly well known for... nationally known for your attempts to get this helicopter service for the west of Ireland, and particularly up here. What motivated you to start all that?
I mean, it was anger. I mean, you're asking what motivated it was anger.
Yes.
I mean, the story, I think, is well known. John Oglesby was a skipper who was from Rue Island, the same island as Mick, and when... word came through that it's a whole combination of things. You see, things are never simple. It's never just one. Joey Murn had been on the radio a few weeks previously with Gay Byrne, and he'd been given out about the helicopters not being on the west coast. And a few days later, some woman phoned up and said, "Is that man not blind? There's one there at Finner every day when she passes." And Gay's response was, "There, I'm caught again. Those political types have trapped me." And he sort of dismissed Joey's thing, not understanding that what was sitting in Finner was a single-engine helicopter that can only go over the sea if it's got a fixed-wing aircraft with it, because if its engine goes, it's gone, right? And the woman didn't understand the whole thing. I was angry at how Joey was treated, even though I'd never met Joey at that stage. Then, say, John Oglesby, who was like king of Uwe, because he had made... He had made good. He was local boy, made good. He was one of the biggest fishing boats in the country. It was. I'm a tremendous fatalist. I believe in fate. There were so many things about the nature of John Oglesby's death. A block fell on him, and he was very seriously injured, and he bled to death. Right. And I just thought, in this day and age, there was a breakdown in communications, there was a breakdown in medical procedure, plus there was nobody could get to him in time. I mean, there was a whole combination, and it brought together all the elements that are wrong on the West Coast as regards search and rescue. So you might say you take it as an indicator. I mean, it didn't happen like that, but looking back on it, I was very angry, anyway, that anyone could die in such circumstances. And when Mick was going off to the wake, I said, look, it's very hard to get fishermen together. I said, all the skippers are going to be there. Bring up to them. What are they going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And he came back and he said, nothing. And I thought, you just don't do nothing. You know, normally it's a crew member that dies and people sort of sweep it under the carpet. Mm-hmm. Or the accident involved drink or inexperience or something. Mm-hmm. But in this case, nothing could be faulted. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand why they weren't gelling. So I went in to have a word with Joey Murn and all the rest, and they told me I was wasting my time, and I went to talk to a few other people. I mean, it was very...
You're getting the brush off from everybody, weren't you?
Yes, yes. And, of course, the more I was getting the brush off, the more angry I was getting, really. Particularly when I phoned down the West Coast to see if really... Maybe this is ridiculous. You know, maybe they don't need anything. Hmm. But when I talked to people down the West Coast, I got a different picture. So I realised that Killybegs was not the same as the rest. Hmm. I mean, it's all history now. I mean, there was a long battle, is all
yes,
I'd say.
That,
but it got there. And I did get the support of people in Killybegs in the end. You know, but people didn't know me. I didn't know anyone in Killybegs. Wee housewife, young kids. Hmm. You know, why should they listen to you?
Hmm.
I must say, I never wanted to get involved. I wanted the fishermen's organisation to run
themselves.
The meeting. But because they thought it would be a failure, they didn't want to.
You decided
get
to
so they
take
thought,
the bull by the horns yourself.
Yes.
And you talk to Gable on the Late Late. Now, this is where everybody knows you from, you see, the Late Late Show.
It's funny, because I'd been on TV before that, you know. But nobody, it has amazed me. Maybe because we weren't great Late Late Show watchers in our house.
Okay, John, what happened? I know it's a long, fairly involved story, but what was the end result of all, you know, trying to get this helicopter service from the West?
Well, the end result is on the 3rd of August last year, the government made an announcement that they are going to put out to tender for a medium-range helicopter, one capable of going out 200 miles and picking up 20 people.
Mm.
Once it's in place, the Dauphin, already at Shannon, will move up to Finner. Our main problem was the communication system was in chaos. All that is now going to be streamlined under one department, Department of Marine, and various people are going to be appointed and training schedules and things put into operation. So once the government made a public statement as to what they were going to do, I disbanded the committee. Now, there was disagreement on that. Some felt that unless the thing is in place, you don't disband. But people, like you said, people seeing you on TV and all, people can put people into positions of influence that they're not really in. We had a certain thing to do. We did it. We go. It's over to someone else now to make sure it's implemented. Everyone is only a link in a chain. No one is the chain.
Joan, you're going to Galway University at the moment. You're doing a two-year course on what?
Rural development.
What's that about?
It's about attempts at keeping communities in the rural context. I mean, people are leaving at such a rate, and really it's looking at EC policies and national policies that are impinging on the rural communities and the effect of them.
Yeah, you're trying to keep the people in the rural communities. Do you feel that there's a body trying to remove them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's like everyone, I mean, the clichés or the jargon is that everyone's moving to the centre and leaving the periphery and all the rest. And really what I'm looking at is the dynamics involved, policies involved, reasons for good, bad or indifferent, and methods of redressing it, good, bad or indifferent.
And the fishing industry, you're studying that as part of the...
Well, that's what my particular study is on, thesis or whatever you want to call it. And I'm looking at the conflict between the pelagic and the whitefish sector.
You have time to go to university in Galway, and you have a husband and a family. and all the rest of it happening.
Well,
how do you do it?
The course is a part-time master's, right?
Right.
It's Friday and Saturday. Kids go out the door at 8:30. I get up at 6 early, so I get all the housework done and their dinner done for the evening and all the rest. They go out at 8:30. I leave at 8:40. I'm in Galway in time for 2:00 lectures. Lectures are on till 9:00. Lectures then are from 9 to 1 on a Saturday. And I'm home with the weekend shopping by 6:00 on Saturday.
You have a heart like a lion, Joan. I hope you do very well in your course. I hope you get your master's and keep doing good work down that, around that neck of the woods.
Thank you very much indeed.
Okay. Joan, just before I talk very briefly about the island now, because we're chatting far too much here, what's your last record going to be?
My last record is The Grand You Will, Sweet Sean Davies. Because I think you'll notice I had no Celtic element there at all, so I think I'd need to remind myself of my roots and my emotions.
Okay, we'll have that in a minute now. Would you be fit to forage for yourself? Would you be happy with your own company?
Oh, I'd be very happy with my own company.
Mm.
I would delight in it. There's a book that I wouldn't take with me, but it's a book called Gaining Ground by Joan Barefoot. And it's my dream. It's where a woman up and walks away from everyone and hides herself away for about the next 20 years. Doing her own thing and only coming out once a year to get supplies, and it's my dream.
Well, here you are. I'm bringing your dreams, making them come true here.
That's why I'm here.
Okay. Now, getting on to the book, what books would you choose to take with you?
I would take my very first book, no hesitation, is Orthodoxy, G.K. Chesterton, because it's a book that had tremendous impact on me many, many years ago, and one that it would... you'd never tire of reading it or what it's saying, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly its chapter on sanity.
Mm, all right. You can have that. Right. You already have the Bible, whether you like it or not.
No,
you have it.
No,
good
take
reading. And what's your second book?
My second book would be a bit like the Bible, you know, one of these books that you often take down and go with a bit here and a bit there, but a book that you also often start, as I did with the Bible, from page one and try and work your way through.
Mm.
And this book, in this case, is Jo Lee's Ireland, 1912 to 1985. It's a book, as I say, like the Bible, I've taken down many times, plugged into it, started then from page one, trying to work sort of chronologically through it, and have never managed. But hopefully on the island I'd
You've plenty of time. You'll manage it. And what about a luxury, Joan?
Luxury. That's a problem. I hadn't really thought of that one. You sprung that one on me. I think you had mentioned yourself earlier something about a radio, and much as I like to be on my own and all, I also like to know what's going on out there, and could keep a watching brief.
All right, Joan. Thank you very much indeed for being my castaway this week. Continued success in your life with the boys and Mick, and keep an eye on the choppers for us, will you?
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ripples in the water of the rock pool sun, ripples in the water of the rock pool sun, ripples in the water of the rock pool sun, and the boats are in for winter. Donalon Cogie, will you marry me? Donalon Cogie, will you marry me? Donalon Cogie, will you marry me? Will I carry your three children?
Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara. Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara.
Donalon Cogie, will you sail with me? Donalon Cogie, will you sail with me? From here to Fakaranga.
I can feel the tide falling in the rain. I can feel the tide falling in the rain. I can feel the tide falling in the rain. But the wind is surely rising.
Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara. Ripples in the rock pools.